Okay, so now to jump back into the history of the church that we were talking about the past couple of sessions. So we had gone through up to the 8th century when we have the 7th Ecumenical Council. So we talked about the first 6 Ecumenical Councils. Do y'all remember we talked about the Monophysite heresy and then the Monothelite heresy, which was the one will teaching, and then how St. Maximus the Confessor taught that in fact Christ has two wills, a divine will and a human will. Y'all remember that? And if Christ doesn't have a human will, then our will is not healed, because whatever is assumed is healed, and whatever is not assumed is not healed, right? That's what we understand. So that's why it had to be that Christ took on our humanity fully, without leaving anything out. The only thing that he doesn't have is sin. But everything that's truly human, you know, because sin isn't actually part of our nature at all. But everything that's truly human, he takes on in order to heal it. So this is why the St. Maximus and the fathers of the church said he had to have a human will. So we talked about that up to the 6th Ecumenical Council. Now we come to the 7th Ecumenical Council, and the issue that the 7th Ecumenical Council dealt with was iconoclasm. What's iconoclasm? Well, it's, you know, icon. And it means breaking, smashing icons, right? You've heard this before, something's iconoclastic, you know, if somebody's like kind of rebelling against the traditions or something like that. But specifically, this is actually that people started teaching against the icons. Well, by tradition, icons had existed in the life of the church from the time of the Apostle Luke, you know, who was an artist in addition to being a physician and an evangelist. So he painted the first portraits of the Mother of God with Christ as a child and so on. And by tradition, we still have some of those icons from the hand of St. Luke in the church in various places. Now, so icons had existed. There was a rich history of iconography in the life of the church. So much so that, you know, the churches in Constantinople were full of lots of icons, and people, if they could, they had them in their homes and so on. Now, along comes this idea, and we don't know for sure, but it may have been influenced by Islam. Islam is against the use of images. You can't make an image of like a living thing or a person or anything like that. You can't have those in the mosques, right? So in mosques, all you can have is abstract art. Like you can have patterns, but you can't have an image of a living thing because of the danger of idolatry is kind of the idea. So they're opposed to that. Now, we don't know for sure, but it was right around the same time that when iconoclasm appeared in the Roman Byzantine Empire, it was shortly after Islam had begun spreading. And the first emperor, a Byzantine Roman Christian, at least in name, emperor, who started enforcing iconoclasm was Emperor Leo the Isaurian, Isaurian. And then after him, so that was in 730, and then after him, his son Constantine also was an iconoclast. And so at first, it sort of went in stages. So like the first thing was, well, we think that kissing the icons is idolatrous, so you have to stop kissing them, but they left them there. And then they said, well, in order to make sure people don't kiss them, we'll keep them up high, but all the ones that are down low we have to get rid of, you know. And then gradually it was like, they're all coming out, you know, no more icons in the churches. And if Christians, clergy, bishops, priests, lay people, whoever, insisted on keeping the icons, as many of them did, then they were persecuted by the authority of the emperors. So Leo and then Constantine. Now, this continued for several decades, and then in 787, Irene was the empress. Her husband had died. Her son was not old enough to reign yet. He was a child. So she was the regent, you know. So she called an ecumenical council, and at that ecumenical council, Empress Irene, they determined that once and for all, that icons were appropriate for Christian worship, that rightly understood and rightly venerated, they were not idolatrous, but exactly the opposite of idolatry, because they lead us to Christ. They serve as a constant reminder of the incarnation, you know, that the invisible God became visible and we can see him and we can touch him. And the icon is a constant reminder of that. So we understand this in terms of incarnation, not in terms of idolatry. So this is what the Seventh Ecumenical Council declared. Now, before the council, leading up to it, there had been incredible work done by Saint John of Damascus. So he's kind of the hero, one of the heroes of this period. You know, Saint John was a courtier in Damascus under the Muslim caliph there in Damascus. His father had occupied an important position, and then he also did. However, at a certain point, he left Damascus and he became a monk in Palestine. He was, because the Muslims had already conquered Palestine, it was no longer within the official Byzantine Empire. What that meant was he was free to act and to write, especially against iconoclasm and in defense of the icons, and the emperor couldn't touch him because he wasn't under the emperor, because he's in Palestine, which is now under the Muslims. So it's kind of an interesting, ironic thing that he had a certain kind of protection being under the Muslims because iconoclasm was going on. So he wrote all of these treatises. However, at a certain point, he was slandered to the caliph. The caliph became suspicious of him, thinking that he was wanting to rebel against him or something, that he was undermining his authority. And so he had his hand cut off, his right hand that he would use. In addition to defending icons, he was also, you know, an iconographer and a hymnographer and a very important father of the church. He's known for writing a work called The Exact Exposition of the Orthodox Faith. That was the title that he gave to it. And then this is, of course, long before the split with Rome, but simply he's saying this is the Orthodox, the true teaching of the fathers. And really what it is like a summary of everything that came before him, you know, everything that had been handed down from generation to generation. So he's a very important father of the church, but he's specifically and especially known for his defense of the icons. And he's the one who explained very clearly that the honor that's given to the image passes to the prototype. So it's not that we don't honor the image in and of itself, but it represents the person who's in the icon, right? So if we kiss the icon of Christ, we're kissing Christ, is the idea, you know? And just like, you know, if you kiss the hand of the priest, you're kissing the hand of Christ, you know? And we even say we honor one another as though we're honoring Christ. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't also respect each other as human beings, but that's because we're all made in the image of God, right? So we have this idea of how icons work. And so St. John of Damascus articulated that, and so that became the basis for the Seventh Ecumenical Council, and that was when the church decided once and for all, officially, that icons were appropriate. And not only were they appropriate, but they were necessary for right Christian worship because of what they do to safeguard the doctrine of the Incarnation. Yes, Anna.
That we have the icon of St. John on our iconostasis.
That's right. We have an icon of St. John of Damascus on the iconostasis. It's on the right side.
Holding the icon of the
That's right. So and that that icon, it represents the fact that it was through her prayers that he was healed. His hand, which was cut off, was restored miraculously as he was praying before an icon of the Theotokos and asking for healing, and it was healed. So you see that icon of him holding the icon of the Theotokos and with his hand healed. You also see an icon of the Theotokos where there's a hand there that represents his hand that she healed. So that's another reminder of that event. Okay. However, like with many of these heresies, it persisted past this point. And in particular, a few decades after the Seventh Ecumenical Council, there was a new emperor who was again an iconoclast. And Emperor Leo the Armenian, this one was the Isaurian, the Armenian, he reinstituted iconoclasm, which lasted again for a few more decades until 843. Before I mention what happened in 843, I'll mention that, again, there were people who were tortured for their defense of the icons, and two who are famous saints of the church are, I won't write their names down, but it's Saint Theodore the Branded and his brother Saint Theophanes the Branded. Why are they called the Branded? Well, the emperor had 12 badly composed, that's how it's written in the story, you know, badly composed lines of poetry branded on their face. Basically saying that they idiotically defended the icons and that kind of thing. They just branded their face with these lines of poetry. And Bishop Basil tells the story of how, you know, the bishop wears this hat. It's called the klobuk, and it has a kind of a black veil, and it's split into two. And he said the tradition is that when it started being split was in the time of these saints, Theodore and Theophanes the Branded, who were, after iconoclasm ended, they were like heroes. Everybody loved them. Everybody would like flock to them when they saw them and saw their face because they knew that they had suffered for Christ, right? So in order to avoid all that attention, I can't remember whether it was Theodore or Theophanes, one of them cut his veil, his monastic veil that he would wear over the hat, which is traditional, but he cut it and would wrap it around his face and would go around with his face covered up because he didn't want to be treated like a hero. So that's where that comes from. Okay, but in 843, what happened was Empress Theodora now, again an empress, ended iconoclasm officially, and it never came back after that. This was the final, what we call, triumph of orthodoxy. And so it took place on the first Sunday of Great Lent, and the whole church, all the people, the clergy and people in Constantinople declared that iconoclasm was over, that it was right to venerate icons. They processed through the streets with icons, and they also once again declared that they held the faith of the fathers. From that time, we have the custom of celebrating the triumph of Orthodoxy on the first Sunday of Great Lent. So this is what we do with the procession of icons. And we read what's called the Synodicon, which is a statement of faith and declaring that we hold the faith of the fathers, we hold the faith of the ecumenical councils, and so on. Now, I'll just mention about the Seventh Ecumenical Council that, from an Orthodox perspective, that was the last council that has this sort of standing and title of ecumenical council. There are later councils that are important for us, but they're not at the same level, you could say. The Roman Catholic Church, on the other hand, recognizes 21 ecumenical councils, including up to the last one in the 1960s, which is Vatican II, where they, you know, changed the way they did the Mass and everything like that. But the Orthodox Church, officially we say there are 7 ecumenical councils with certain other important councils that took place after that that we recognize, but not with the same degree of authority, you could say. Now, we're going to shift gears a little bit and talk about continuing forward in history, focusing especially on the topic of the split between East and West. So one thing that we should mention was that back in, 589, yeah. In 589, there was a council of Toledo in Spain, and this was when it was the first council's first kind of official event where the Filioque, who remembers what Filioque means in Latin? Anybody? Filioque? And the Son. Okay? So the Filioque was added to the creed. Now, we understand that there was kind of a good motivation for doing that, at least in part, which was that there was some Arianism that was persisting, and at this council in Toledo, Spain, they were saying, we want to deal with this once and for all, and we believe that Scripture says the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father, but it also says that the Son sends the Holy Spirit. So we're just going to kind of underline the fact that the Son also has authority together with the Father, so we're going to say the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. Okay? So it has this kind of anti-Arian original intent. Of course, the problem is, first of all, it's not in Scripture. Second of all, it wasn't in the Nicene Creed, the original Nicene Constantinopolitan Creed, which is the one that we use. And third, it's just done kind of off in a corner, in a sense. You know, at this council, they decide to change the creed. But it's not done as like an ecumenical decision with the whole church. So we have problems with that. Now, during the time of iconoclasm, you have these iconoclastic emperors. There's a situation that develops where, meanwhile, in the West, and I mentioned this before, the Western half of the Roman Empire was coming under attack. They were facing great difficulties, and meanwhile, you have the king of the Franks. First of all, it's Pepin or Pepin, and then his son Charlemagne, who comes to power, and eventually is crowned by Pope Leo III as the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. Remember, I mentioned that a couple of times ago. So this is kind of happening in the meantime, while Constantinople's busy dealing with this iconoclasm issue in the West, you have Charlemagne coming to power. What this does is that because the bishop of Rome, the Pope Leo III crowned Charlemagne, there's like this alliance now between the Church of Rome and the Franks, the Frankish kingdom. And they're now going to call this the Holy Roman Empire. Meanwhile, the emperors in Constantinople never recognize him as any kind of Holy Roman anything, right? They don't recognize that. And so this is starting to form a split between East and West. It's, you know, among other things, this is one of the issues leading to the split. So that's going on and eroding the relationship between Rome and Constantinople. Also, shortly after the triumph of Orthodoxy that took place in the East and Constantinople, and certainly, by the way, the Western popes are defenders of the pro-icon position. Okay, so they're for the most part, I mean, it sort of varies by pope, but a lot of them were definitely in favor of what was proclaimed with the triumph of orthodoxy. So it's complex because you have some popes who are strongly supporting this in the East, and some who are starting to move in a different direction. Charlemagne is somewhat iconoclastic. So he starts criticizing the Easterners for their use of icons, saying that that's something heretical, and he starts accusing them of leaving the filioque out of the creed. Okay. They drop the filioque from the creed. Of course, that's ironic because that wasn't in the original creed and it was something that was added later, right? Now, in 853, there's a new Patriarch of Constantinople elected, and that's Saint Photius the Great. And but the Pope at the time, Pope Nicholas I, doesn't recognize him. Now, there had been a situation where there was a patriarch before him named Ignatius, and he was considered to be, for different reasons, not competent to continue serving. So there was a council held, a decision made to have him basically tell him he has to retire. He agreed to do that. He signed paperwork to do that. Saint Photius was elected to replace him. But the Pope in Rome now says, I don't recognize those proceedings. I recognize Ignatius as still the Patriarch of Constantinople and not Saint Photius. So he's trying to intervene in the situation. And he writes a letter at this point that says, the Pope has authority over all the earth and every church. That's what Pope Nicholas I said. Okay? This is an idea that has been developing over a few centuries. It wasn't originally there, certainly, from an Orthodox perspective in Rome. But over the last few centuries, certain popes are starting to make this claim that they say, well, Rome is the seat of Peter, and Peter had authority over the other apostles, therefore the Pope has authority over all the church. Right? From an Orthodox perspective, that's not the way we understand it. We say every bishop is sitting on the seat of Peter. Every bishop is Peter in his local church, you see? So we have a very different way of understanding that. And not to mention, I mean, historically, like if you read Saint Irenaeus, who was a Western bishop in Lyon, and he in his book Against the Heresies, he says Linus was the first bishop of Rome, who was made bishop by the Apostle Peter, but he actually names Linus as the first bishop, consecrated by the Apostle Peter and the other apostles, but in any case, is it just a different account of things? So Saint Photius responds to Pope Nicholas by writing a letter condemning the filioque as heresy, and then he summons a council and excommunicates Pope Nicholas for using the filioque, right? Without sort of the agreement of the whole church, he's acting unilaterally. You can't do that. It's heretical. So the council says Pope Nicholas is out of order. Then there's some political intrigue. Saint Photius, under the influence of the Pope, is deposed. They bring Ignatius back in, and then Ignatius is thrown out again, and they bring Saint Photius back in. So it's very complicated. And then in 879, there was another council that overturned the decisions of the previous council of Rome and withdrew their condemnation of St. Photius. And the Pope at that time, in 879, is now John VIII, and he accepts this decision of this later council, which restores Photius and vindicates him. So it's complicated again, because it's not like every pope was of the same mind. You know, you have one who just wants to be in agreement and at peace with Constantinople, and the next one is saying, the Pope has authority over the whole world, right? It's kind of going back and forth. But by about another century and a half, around the year 1000, you have the Filioque becoming official in Rome. And at that point, when the Filioque becomes official, the Church of Constantinople drops the Pope's name from the diptychs. The diptychs are like the lists of, these are the heads of the local churches, you know, that we commemorate and pray for. It said, we don't recognize the Pope anymore because he's fallen into heresy. Then in 1054, this is kind of the final straw or the last kind of definitive moment of split between the two. The Pope Leo IX is asserting his authority in Constantinople. He's saying that the Filioque is officially part of the creed. Constantinople's in disobedience because they're not using the Filioque. He's also criticizing the Easterners for ordaining married clergy, which the church always did, you know, but that was something that was changed in the West. So it's again, it's like accusing the Eastern Church of sort of changing something, which it was not a change, but it was actually in the West that something changed. So that's true with the Filioque, and it's true with the married clergy. So Pope Leo IX sends this messenger, Cardinal Humbert, and then there were two other cardinals with him who go on this trip, this mission to Constantinople, and they come and they sort of have this conversation with the patriarch. Meanwhile, very interestingly, the Pope dies. So when the Roman Church excommunicated Constantinople, there was not a living pope at the time. It was just these cardinals acting in the name of the no longer living pope, you know, who hadn't been replaced yet. So it's a very murky situation. But in any case, the patriarch in Constantinople, of course, doesn't accept that, says Filioque is heresy. We've never had it. We've always ordained married clergy. There were several other issues, which I won't get into. But suffice it to say that there were a number of things that led up to this split. But the main one is really, the main two are the claims of papal supremacy. And the other churches had always recognized Rome as first among equals, like a position of honor, but not supremacy over the whole church. That was something that developed later. And the issue of the Filioque, which was considered by the Eastern churches to be heretical. Now, so we sort of give this date, 1054, as the official split, but you just have to recognize it developed over a few centuries beforehand, and it took a little while afterwards for it to kind of sink in, because there had been schisms before. Remember when that thing happened with Photius and, you know, the Pope excommunicated Photius, so there was a kind of schism at the time between the two, but it healed. And so I think at least some people, when this happened, they thought, that's not going to last, you know. Well, you know, we'll be able to work this out, but it's continued until now, unfortunately. Now, not long after this, the Western Christians, with the blessing of the Pope, they begin the Crusades. Okay, the whole kind of reason for the Crusades, at least ostensibly, was to free the lands under the dominion of Muslims, so that they could be free to, you know, live as Christians. Right, that was the reason that was given for the Crusades. However, for example, in the First Crusade, when the Latin Crusaders came into Jerusalem and into Antioch, that region, they were coming to liberate them, but actually what they did was they set up new patriarchates with Latin bishops under the Pope, you know, with the Pope, right? So they set up rival churches in those places. So, I mean, they're sowing all kinds of problems, the Crusaders. But the climax and the most tragic event that took place during these Crusades, in at least in some regards, I mean, there are a lot of tragedies, but in 1204, This was the Fourth Crusade, and they were, you know, supposed to be on their way to Palestine, to the Middle East, but they took a detour and went to Constantinople instead, and they attacked Constantinople. You know, which wasn't under any kind of Muslim domination. It was just their Christian brothers and sisters, but refusing to recognize the Pope, you know. And so they attacked them, and they burned Constantinople, and they raped, and they pillaged, and all of these horrible things. So this was supposedly Christian crusaders attacking their Orthodox brothers and sisters in Constantinople. And
that's the one with the Muslim came to the defense of Orthodox and fought side by side with them, wasn't it?
I don't know. I don't remember reading that. But it's possible.
There was one specific large, and I think it was that one, because their original, like you said, the original path they were supposed to go, you know, constantly.
Right. Well, it would make sense that if they...
It wasn't en route, and well, while we're going to, you know, from A to B, we'll just stop over here.
Right.
Well, they had to go way out of their way to
get there. Yeah, there was no legitimate excuse for it. It was just, they just decided... for whatever reason, that they were an easy target or whatever. Of course, I mean, they couldn't have expected that, you know? It wasn't like, oh yeah, of course, you know, the Western Christians are going to attack us, you know? They didn't expect at all. They knew they had to defend themselves from the Muslims. But, I mean, I can imagine that there were Muslim soldiers around who just say, these guys are a threat, and so they would have... fought against the Western Crusaders around Constantinople. Yeah, I mean that's that's quite possible. There's a famous historian, Sir Stephen Runciman, who wrote, "The Crusaders brought not peace but a sword, and the sword was to sever Christendom." So it was sort of like that. Put that event in 1204 sort of put the nail in the coffin of splitting East and West, you know. It's just like they attacked us, you know. So it felt like an incredible betrayal. Not only that, it was like demoralizing because it was coming from Christians, but in a material sense, Constantinople never recovered. So they were greatly weakened, and they never fully recovered until the Turks finally overran them.
What year was that?
That was 1453. So it took a few more centuries for the Turks to finally conquer Constantinople. But you could say, in a very real sense, it was because of the Fourth Crusade that they were so weakened that they couldn't stand up to the Turks any longer. So this is a great tragedy. However, at the same time, just like with the Serbians, the Serbs at the Battle of Kosovo, who stopped the Turks from advancing into Western Europe, although Constantinople fell to the Turks, it was like they stopped, you know, they went up a little bit. But because the Eastern Roman Empire kept standing against and against and against, they played a critical role in really protecting the West. They were a buffer.
Is that when they took over Greece?
Yeah. Because that was part of... That was
for 400 years.
Right. So, I mean, Greece was part of the Eastern Roman Empire. And then Greece was under Turkish control until the 1820s,
right.
With the War of Independence, when Greece fought for its independence. But Constantinople, of course, is still in Turkey. Okay, also the Crusaders at this point in 1204 set up again a Latin kingdom, including a bishop and everything in Constantinople now. Now, in 1261, the Byzantines, the Eastern Romans, recover control of Constantinople. But like I said, now it's in a very fragile state and never really regains its strength. Then there are a couple of councils that took place I talked about this before, I think, but in 1274, there's the Council of Lyon. Now, again, recognize that the Roman emperors in Constantinople, they're back in power beginning in 1261, but they're facing a dire situation. They're very weak now. They have the Muslims advancing on them. They don't know how long they can hold up. So they start looking to the West again just to say, maybe we can reunite. Maybe we can have the military support of the Westerners, in Italy and France and so on, in Spain. Even though they attacked us, maybe if we will, sign a union with them, then they'll be on our side. So there's a lot of motivation to try to reunite. So there are attempts to do that. There's this council in Lyon, and then a couple of centuries later, right before the fall of Constantinople, they tried it again, and that was in 1438, and that was the Council of Florence, and I think I told you about that before. That's the one where all the bishops signed. They said, fine, we believe in purgatory, we believe in all that stuff you guys believe in. Like, we'll sign it, just to get their support. But St. Mark of Ephesus said, nope, I'm not signing. He's like, I'm not going to sell out, I'm going to be faithful. All the bishops went back home, everybody kicked them out. They said, what? You sold us out, Who cares about the we belong to Christ. If he lets us be destroyed, that's fine. We're never going to deny the faith. And St. Mark of Ephesus, who refused to sign, was considered the hero for not compromising. And then, of course, as I mentioned, in a few years after that, in 1453, the Ottomans finally conquered Constantinople. And it was May 29th, 1453, when the last Christian service was held in Hagia Sophia, that beautiful, most beautiful church in the history of the world in Constantinople. And it was immediately turned into a mosque when they came in, and they whitewashed the icons and everything. And so that's sort of that history between East and West. Now, meanwhile, while all of that's going on, there, from Constantinople, there were missionaries starting to go up north to the Slavs. And the most famous ones were Saints Cyril and Methodius. Saint Cyril is the one from whom you get the name Cyrillic for the script used by in Slavic languages, their alphabet, because he created an alphabet based on the Greek alphabet. They were from St. Cyril and Methodius. They were brothers. They were from Constantinople, and they were brilliant and very pious men, monastic. And so they went as missionaries. And in Thessaloniki, I think I mentioned they were from Thessaloniki. In Thessaloniki, there was a fairly large Slavic population. So they had grown up around Slavic-speaking people. They learned the language. And so they were able to start translating things into their language, create an alphabet and everything. They went up originally into the region known as Moravia, which is the modern Czech Republic. It's right next to Bavaria, Bavaria and Moravia. And these are what are called the southern or western Slavs. But because of the work they did there, even though those people later came under the Roman Church, most in Czech Republic and Germany, they became Catholic, Latinized. Because they did that work there, and their later disciples continued that work, all the groundwork was laid for the Christianization of Russia and all the other Slavic countries that came later. I'm going to skip some stuff. Now, I'll also mention another thing that was going on. This was in the later 800s, in the 860s, when these brothers were working. In 926, also in I'll just mention in the 800s, the Bulgarians, the people in the region which is now Bulgaria, and there was a kingdom there actually, that king decided that he wanted to receive Christianity, and so he asked for missionaries to come, and they became Christian. The Bulgarian king kind of went back and forth, aligning himself with Constantinople and then with Rome and then back with Constantinople. But then in 926, they became an independent church. So that's the Bulgarian, which is to this day the Bulgarian Orthodox Church. They have their own patriarch from that time, 926. 955 was when Princess Olga in Kiev became a Christian, and then her grandson was really the one who converted all the Russians. He was Prince of Kiev, Saint Vladimir. At that time, Kiev, which is now in Ukraine, was kind of like the capital of the Rus, the Russian people. Yeah. Then I'll just mention that in meanwhile, also in what became Serbia, the kingdom of Serbia, there were missionaries there, and the people were becoming Christian. And in 1219 was when they became an independent church, and that took place under Saint Sava. This is his life. He's the first archbishop, and the Church of Serbia became an independent, sort of mature church under Saint Sava. And then in 1346 it became a patriarchate, because just because you're an independent church doesn't mean you, the head of your church has the title patriarch. That came later. Another important date was 1237. This is when the Mongols, called by the Russians, they call them Tartars. They invaded Kiev, and basically they swept across the Russian land and just destroyed and pillaged and everything, and dominated the Russians. And that lasted for about 250 years. So the Russians from 1237 until 1480 were under the Mongols. One famous saint, whose life is just incredible, is Saint Alexander Nevsky, who was the Prince of Novgorod, which is kind of more like if you have Kiev and you have Moscow, well, kind of out, sort of more towards the west, you have this city of Novgorod. And so Saint Alexander Nevsky was the prince there, and he was known for standing up to the Mongols at first, bravely. Actually, they were miraculously delivered from the Mongol invaders at first, and then they were attacked by Teutonic crusaders and Swedes from the west. And Alexander Nevsky led his soldiers and fought them at the River Neva, which is where he gets the name Nevsky, and resisted them. So he became a big hero, and then everybody thought he was going to deliver them from the Tartars. Well, this was still in the 1200s. Actually, what he did was he made a kind of peace with the Mongols, and showed incredible courage in doing it. He went to the capital of the Mongolian Empire and met with their emperor, and basically the emperor said, well, you have to walk through the fire and you have to bow down to the idols and everything like that. And he just said, go ahead and kill me if you want. I'm not going to do that. But he said, you know, I came to show you honor. For whatever reason, God has given our land into your control, and we will do our best to be loyal subjects to you, because God has given our land to you. But he said, but we're not going to bow down to idols. So we're not going to do that. So it was because of that, actually, that Russia ended up being preserved under Mongol control, but they remained Orthodox. In fact, many Mongols ended up becoming Orthodox, and you know, there's plenty of Mongolian blood in amongst Russians. So Then there's a famous missionary, St. Stephen of Perm, in the mid-1300s, who was working in like the far eastern Siberian part of Russia, converting many of the natives there to Orthodoxy. Now, as we're sort of getting into this later period of talking about the Slavic churches, so there's the independence from the Mongols in 1480. No sooner do they become independent from the Mongols than now we have issues with the West again. And so what took place about a century after that was the Austro-Hungarian Empire starts conquering Western lands, and they end up taking over basically Ukraine. Comes under the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Well, they're Roman Catholic, and now they say all those people have to become Roman Catholic. So there came to be, under this kind of political influence, a union that took place in Brest-Litovsk in 1596. It was a council of union. And what took place was that millions of Orthodox Christians, especially in the region of Ukraine, Belarus, what we call the Carpathian Mountains, the Carpatho-Russians, they end up being kind of like forcibly united with Rome. They're allowed to keep their liturgy and all their practices and their vestments and everything, but they have to recognize the Pope. And so they're, from that time, because of this union, they're called Uniates. They're also called Byzantine Catholic. There are lots of different names for them, Ruthenian. So there's this whole kind of Uniatism that takes place. Also, something similar takes place under the Church of Antioch, which is that in 1724, there's a group under pressure that of Orthodox in the Antiochian Patriarchate that unite with Rome, and they're called Melkites, and they exist to this day, the Melkite Church. They recognize the Pope, but they have Byzantine liturgy. After this union, many of the Uniate churches eventually returned to the Orthodox Church, especially around Kiev. So in 1770, 1,200 Uniate churches in Kiev returned to the Orthodox Church. In 1793, 2,300 Uniate churches return in Western Russia. And then that brings us right up to the beginning of Orthodoxy in America. One significant date for that is that the first Russian group of monastic clergy and lay monastic people, like St. Herman of Alaska, come to Alaska in 1794. And so Orthodoxy begins to be established. There were already Russians in Alaska. It belonged to Russia, and they had like Russian fur traders and everything there, but there were no established churches or clergy until this point. And so they came over, St. Herman and the others, they started establishing Orthodoxy in Russia. So at least in that part of America, that's the beginning of Orthodoxy. Meanwhile, there are different Greek settlements in places like St. Augustine, Florida, and New Orleans. So it's the oldest Orthodox church in the lower 48, you know, not counting Alaska, is established in New Orleans, you know. But there's an even older community in St. Augustine, but there wasn't a church that continued from their settlement there. Then I mentioned the War of Independence of Greece in 1821, and Greek becoming independent. The Greek church became autocephalous in 1833. So in other words, they're now independent of Constantinople, even though they still recognize the patriarch. They're able to govern themselves, which is good, because at that point, the Patriarch of Constantinople is very limited because he's under the Turks. And so now they're free, and they want to be able to run their own church. Antioch has always been. Yeah, it's been. It was one of the original patriarchates, the Church of Antioch. And I forgot to mention the Georgian Church. The Church of Georgia, they had, by tradition, St. Andrew went to that region, but Christianity wasn't strongly established until St. Nina came in the 4th century. She's known as the evangelizer of Georgia. And then Christianity was very strong there for a long time, but they were under the Antiochian Church. So Antioch provided their bishops and kind of maintained the church in Georgia until the 700s. That's when they started to become independent. And then in 1010, the year 1010, they became a patriarchate. So now you have a patriarchate of Georgia.
Is that Antioch, Syria, or in Turkey? Which Antioch are you talking about?
It was in Syria, and now it's in Turkey.
It was in Syria in the beginning.
Yeah, because when the Turks came over, now it's in Turkey. Okay. When the Turks took over, it's in Turkey. But now we've moved the patriarchate, the headquarters, to Damascus,
right,
which is in modern Syria.
Right.
But the Antakya, the actual city of Antioch, is in modern-day Turkey.
Yeah, that's what I'm
talking. But anyway, it was still our patriarchate was existed in Antioch until I think it was the 1300s when they moved to Damascus. Anyway, the Georgian church received its autocephaly, became an independent church. Not until 1872 did the Romanian Orthodox Church become an independent church. Now, it sort of goes along with politically, these countries were, there was kind of nationalism, and as they sort of broke free from the Turks, they wanted their own countries. So now you have like Serbia and Russia, Romania and Bulgaria, and they're all free from the Turks eventually, and they have their own national churches, and eventually they all have patriarchs. So the Romanian church received a patriarch. Then another thing I'll mention, we'll just kind of end with a few last dates from American Orthodoxy. 1895 is when there's a group of Syrian Antiochian Orthodox in New York, immigrants in New York, and they form a Syrian Orthodox Benevolent Society, like a brotherhood to take care of one another, and they start requesting a priest. We want a priest who can speak Arabic, who can preach to us in our language. But they're all Orthodox at that time in 1895 are under the Russian church, right? Because they started in Alaska. So there's a Bishop Tikhon, the Russian bishop, who later became patriarch in Russia and died as a martyr and as a saint, Saint Tikhon. He was the bishop in America at the time, and he arranges for an Arabic-speaking priest who's living in Russia to come to America. And his name is Father Raphael Hawaini, and we know him as Saint Raphael. So he comes, he begins ministering to the Arabic-speaking Orthodox, going back and forth across the country. Eventually he's made bishop, and eventually we canonized him as a saint. All Orthodox Christians were under the Russian Church, but that was disrupted in 1917 with the Communist Revolution. Communist Revolution happened. A lot of the clergy were called back to Russia. There was mass chaos. There was no clear leadership. Meanwhile, you have these different groups speaking different languages kind of saying, well, we need to just be connected with our mother countries back home. So that you have the Syrian Orthodox Antiochians just coming under the mother church in Antioch or in Damascus, the Greeks coming under Constantinople, and so on. So that's what happened. Now we have jurisdictionalism with all these different jurisdictions in America and not yet a united American Orthodox Church, but we hope that eventually we will have a united American Orthodox Church. Any questions?
I have questions.
Yes, ma'am.
Where are we today in dialogue with the West? Coming together, East and the West.
You know, there are always dialogues, but we always end up at an impasse because we're not changing anything. So, and basically, until now, you've always ended up with this these obstacles. It's become more difficult because, for example, the first Vatican Council in the 1870s, whenever it was, declared that the Pope was infallible. Mm-hmm. So now not only does he have supremacy over the whole world, which they had already claimed, but now he's infallible. And of course they say, well, that's ex cathedra, which means that only concerning matters of doctrine, ex cathedra means from his seat. You know, when he's kind of in his position as Pope, not like about anything he says, he's infallible. But still, we just say that's impossible. There's no human being who can be infallible like that. Like, only God is infallible, you know. So that made it worse. Then there was the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception, which we don't recognize. Mm-hmm. And then all the other older things that we had problems with, none of those have changed officially. Now, there are Roman Catholic scholars who say the filioque was a big mistake, but that hasn't changed officially. And until it does, it's just not, if we think that's a heresy. Now, there are Orthodox who say, well, it's not a heresy, it's a difference of opinion or something. But plenty of Orthodox saints have said that it is a heresy, so like that's a big problem. Anyway, I think something helpful is what Metropolitan Hilarion of the Russian Orthodox Church has said, which is that he doesn't think realistically in this world we're going to reunite with Rome before the Lord comes again. It just doesn't, unless something radically changes, which it could, especially with all the crazy stuff that's going on in the Roman Catholic Church, you know, if it's shaken up enough, you know what I mean? Like, if there's enough of a disaster, things could change. You never know what God can do. But just the way things have gone, it doesn't look like we're any closer to reuniting. But he says, when it comes to, like, moral issues, at least the official position, what you actually see happening is another matter, but the official position, we're in agreement to a very large extent. So what he said, what he argues for, Metropolitan Hilarion, he's like the spokesman for the Russian Orthodox Church, he does all of their PR. He says we should see each other as allies in the kind of the cultural war. And that's probably the best we can do at this point, is just to kind of say, well, we all agree that abortion's not good, so let's support each other in that, you know, sort of trying to resist.
I ask is the last two or three popes have, you know, expressed a desire to be a bit more hopeful about it occurring.
Yeah, but
honestly,
it's like, okay, but those are just words until something changes. You know what I mean? It's like with the pedophilia thing. Like, you can make all the statements you want that you think it's bad, but until you actually do something to change the culture, so what? Like, say whatever you want. It doesn't mean anything until you do something. Mm-hmm. It's like that. I mean, you can say we want to be reunited. Okay, great. Well, it's not going to happen until you address all these changes that you've made that we can't accept, you know, unfortunately.
So when you were talking earlier about when you said the Bulgarians became their own church, you were talking about having their own patriarchate, not breaking off.
No. So all of these autocephalous churches that I mentioned, they're all in communion. Mm-hmm. We're all in communion with each other, but now they're self-governing, and yes, in some cases they have their own patriarch, or in the case of, for example, Albania and Greece, they're self-governing, mm-hmm. but they don't have their own patriarch. The Albanian church is an interesting one. You know, it has an archbishop, Archbishop Anastasios, who's the head of their church. He doesn't have the title of patriarch, but other churches are not to interfere with their internal church business. So they have autocephalous. They have a relationship with the Church of Constantinople, but they're self-governing. The autonomous churches that are under the Patriarchate of Constantinople have kind of a limited relationship of basically just a relationship of respect, like daughter church to parent church type of thing, but they're able to elect their own bishop and that type of thing. So,
I have a question about Byzantine Catholics.
Yes, ma'am.
So, you said that they kept like Orthodox liturgy.
Yes.
But they sort of submitted to the Pope. So, like today, Byzantine Catholics, does their liturgy look more like ours or more like?
Like ours.
Okay.
Like, at least on the surface, you might not be able to tell. Although, there might be some subtle differences. I'm not sure. I think there are different groups, some of whom are allowed to not say the filioque. I mean, it's like, it looks a lot like, because of political expediency, the Church of Rome is basically, you know, like they've made these kinds of concessions, like, as long as you recognize the Pope, you can keep doing things, everything, you know, the way you do it. They have married priests. In other words, things that otherwise aren't allowed for Latin clergy and so on, they're allowed for the Byzantine Catholics. But they're in communion with Rome and they're not in communion with the Orthodox Church. However, like I said, many of them returned to the Orthodox Church. And actually, there was a huge movement in the U.S. in the 20th century where there were thousands of uniates. Now, like the OCA, you know, the OCA, a lot of the people in the OCA, now the demographics are changing now because they've had a lot of converts, but earlier, like in the 20th century, many of the people in the OCA were actually former uniates who had returned to Orthodoxy in the U.S.
Okay.
And this was under, there was this, he's a saint for us, Saint Alexis Toth. He was a uniate, Carpatho-Russian, actually, his group became the Carpatho-Russian diocese, but he was from the Carpathian Mountains in the western kind of Russian land. They had immigrated over here. He was a priest, married and everything, but a uniate. And basically, he went on some business to the local Roman Catholic bishop, who just treated him like scum because he wasn't Latin and and he's married and whatever. And then they were being treated like this, and they were going, well, wait a minute, you know, we're Orthodox anyway, you know, like that's really our heritage, and so why couldn't we become Orthodox again? So they started contacting the Patriarch of Constantinople and so on, and they ended up coming in to the church. So the OCA has a lot of Carpatho-Russian people, and then there's also a Carpatho-Russian diocese.
So doctrinally, though, are the Byzantine Catholics more Western or Eastern?
Probably, I mean, it just probably depends on who you talk to. I'm sure a lot of them have been influenced by Roman Catholic doctrine, but at least some of them in some places are probably pretty Orthodox. But it's like by tradition now, they recognize the Pope, like especially the ones who've been for generations, that's what they've been. I mean, I've known some, I've been friends with some, and they would just say, well, you know, we think the Pope is, like his claims are valid and so on. So, I mean, obviously, there's, to some degree, doctrinally, they're in line with Rome if they believe that about the Pope. But they have to, otherwise they would leave and become Orthodox, you know what I mean? And the ones who say, wait a minute, this isn't what our ancestors believed, they do become Orthodox.
Okay.